Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is July 6, 2006. Today's session is entitled Muslims in the USA, presented by Nellie Van Doren Harder, number VA-N 2006-08. Let's listen in.
Elements of all the things that I've been talking about all the time this week and that we're going to talk about Muslims in the USA. And find a space. There's still some spaces left, but maybe you want to pull up a chair. I can put my skirts on the floor. Doesn't need a chair, really. Okay, well, thanks all for coming. Again, reading the audience, who has not heard any of the talks about Islam? Okay, so I have to repeat a bit.
No.
Oh, you don't? Okay. So all of us who have, which is the majority, do you remember what were the main topics that we've been discussing, as in what were the main themes that went through the talks this week? What is happening in the Islamic world?
What's in the news?
What's in the news?
They're trying to, or at least the extremists are trying to establish a worldwide caliphate,
yeah, the caliph. The extremists try to make one unified Islamic caliphate, kingdom, so to speak, with one caliph, one ruler, as it was during the time when the Prophet Muhammad ruled the community and when his successors, the first four rightly guided caliphs, ruled the whole community. Never mind, the three of them were murdered in their sleep, you know. And they were rightly guided, pure, and it was the purest of times. And so that is, and they want to unify, remember, to make a Calvinist type of Islam, a puritanical type of Islam. And that's why I wrote on the board MSA, the Muslim Student Association, because the book that Liz and Kimberly handed me, the story that it starts with, talks exactly about the different elements that I've been mentioning. First of all, this is about a mother who is unwed. She's Pakistani, and she chooses to get her son, to keep her son, and the father leaves her or doesn't want. I'm not quite sure. I had to read it really fast because I had to clean my room today. She is reflecting on what would have happened to her in Pakistan and how things have changed. Because remember, we talked about 1970s, that's when Saudi Arabia started to pay concerted efforts to train Muslim missionaries who all speak the same, think the same, act the same, dress the same, and are the most boring people on earth, as far as I'm concerned, to spread Islam according to their vision. And that we see maturing. That we see now, we see this, remember in former Russia, where that broke up and the Muslim states could be Muslim again, that's where they went in. They started in the Middle East, countries like Egypt, and you now see, somehow the fruits of their efforts. They work by fear, by the way. I don't know if we talked about that. They instill literally the fear of God in people. They say, if you don't do this, you are a bad Muslim, and bad Muslims, of course, go to hell. And who wants to burn, right? So that is really, their whole discourse is based on fear. But she describes, for example, Pakistan, where in 1980, she says, few women were imprisoned for having children out of wedlock. In 2002, most of the nearly 1,500 women in Pakistani jails were imprisoned for having crossed societal boundaries. So for having had an affair or having becoming engaged without the consent of their parents. In 2002, a previously lenient Malaysian province passed a law making zina, adultery, a criminal offense, which it officially is according to Muslim law. So we see that this extremism is taking grip of societies, and the first victims are women. The first victims are the women. The second victims are the non-Muslims. And it is, sorry, nothing has changed in the world since the beginning. It's all about sex, drugs, and rock and roll. That's what it's about. You know, all the crimes that have to do with sex, one way or the other, those are at the forefront of the media. Drugs, you know, wine, that people cannot drink wine, or they cannot drink anything that has anything alcoholic in it, because, you know, self-fermentation, remember, things ferment sometimes. And then money. It is very much about money. We talked about that. And then she talks about, for example, the Nigerian case of Amina Lawal. We know that, right? And then she goes on to describe how her mosque gets very agitated by the fact that she refuses to take the women's entrance, but that she enters through the man's entrance. And I'll come back to that, because that has to do with the hyper. I've written there. I saw your hand. So the hyper. So, and in the mosque, remember, I told you that in Europe, and now I tell you also in the United States, the extremist-minded Muslim groups are very much represented in the Muslim Student Association. And that came out of the Muslim Brothers in Egypt, we talked about that. And they try to take hold of the mosques. And before I go on, I'll let you ask your question.
We have the name of the book that you're talking from.
Yeah, sure. The book is called Because I Said So by Camilla Perry and Kate Moses. And it is from Liz and Kimberly, and they were so kind to hand it to me. This is really the blessing of holding. People keep handing me things that I can use in class. Anyway, but so she describes that who is the leader of the mosque? The mosque that wants to kind of have almost a witch trial, because she is trespassing the rules. Who set those rules? Not the original builders of the mosque. That one of the original builders was her father. The rules are set by an elder, a university professor, active in the Muslim Student Association. Yeah, and she calls it Ziploc justice, because out of a Ziploc bag he gets the papers that then say who will be the committee condemning her, right? And then I cannot read it all for you, but then she goes on and she tells about how on the internet her trial by Ziploc justice in the mosque is being discussed, and that people say she deserves death because remember, according to Islamic law, you're going to be stoned when you are pregnant out of wedlock. Now, I cannot say very much more, but it has this book, this one story has all the ingredients of what we have been discussing. And yesterday we talked about Europe, and we looked at the Muslim community there, and remember we came to the awareness that most of the Muslims are not as well educated as the Muslims here. Muslims here are often professionals, people who came as students, who stayed, or people who immigrated, for example, from Iran when the Shah's regime fell, and those people often were quite wealthy. And that most of the lower class Muslims here are refugees. And then above that you have the level of people who run shops, who run small businesses. So there's but remember, the main difference was European societies are actually very closed. Remember that? We talked about that. How in Europe you cannot really move up, or you say, I can't find a job here. For example, you're trained as a plumber. You can't find a job as a plumber. Yeah, that's of course when hell freezes over. But you know, you can't find a job. I'm just gonna work as a carpenter. In Europe, at least in the country where I was born and raised, I was like, no, you were trained as a plumber. You have to wait or re-educate. You cannot just go and say, I'm gonna go ahead and open a carpenter shop. And you can't even open a shop yourself. Did you know that? You have to do all kinds of exams, and then some civil servant will tell you if you are allowed to open up. You are nodding, you know what I mean? Yeah, some civil servant will tell you if you are allowed to open your shop or not. So you see, it's a very different society, really a very rigid society, and it's much harder to move in there. And that is a big difference here. People, you know, well, we can do what we want, right? That's the wonderful thing of America. But anyway, what you have then is that Muslims coming from Muslim countries slowly have become more and more influenced by the Muslim Student Association and by people who have like-minded ideas, and more extremist-minded ideas, or they have become what I call hyper-Muslims. You know, their Islamic identity is their first frontier. It's the most important identity. So they while they would in Pakistan or in Egypt, you know, they probably couldn't care less, and they would pray at home. Now they go to the mosque to show that they are Muslims and they have a Muslim community. So that is, of course, yesterday someone said, but that you said that, right? But that's something that lots of immigration communities do. Didn't you say that? Right? And it's true. Immigrants become hyper. You know, I start to eat things I never thought about eating in Holland because I'm here. And so you know you somehow want to also have to come to terms with the huge move you made and so forth and so forth. So we see that. Now, so this is a little bit about yesterday and today, but let us first look at the type of Muslims that we have in the United States. And I have to look at my notes now, because do we have any idea how many what the percentage is of Muslims? How many Muslims? How many million?
In the U.S.
2 million?
Well, nobody knows exactly. It seems to be between 4 and 6. Bottom line, it's as much as many as Lutherans. Yeah, and Presbyterians. You know, it's quite a big community. And as I said, they come from all over. But let me tell you one thing, what we see in America. We see the hyper identity. We see the Muslim Student Association trying to, you know, unify things, but we also have a very considerable community of African American Muslims. Were we aware of that?
Yes.
Those were the first Muslims, and I come back to that. So those are, you know, USA Muslims and have been born and raised here, and they do things that really rattle the Muslim world. Have we all heard about Amina Wadud? Who has heard about what Amina Wadud did last year, March? Well, according to the Muslim law, where you remember in the Sharia, in the Muslim law, you have a part that tells all the rituals and all the worship. According to the Muslim law, a woman is not allowed to preach the Friday sermon to both men and women. Actually, she's not allowed to preach the Friday sermon, period. Simply because she could be unclean, and the Friday service is part of the ritual, the preaching. Amina Wadud, African American Muslim woman, daughter of a Methodist preacher, she decided last year March, I'm going to see what happens if I break that rule. And she did that in New York, and she tried to do it in the mosque, and the mosque kicked her out, and then she could do it in a community center of a church. That's a little bit of negative. I don't think church should have been involved at all, because, you know, it's not a good connection. But, so she gave the Friday service and led the Friday prayer for men and women. Well, what do you think happened in the Muslim world?
Well, they got upset.
What? They got upset. They got, you know, aneurysms. God, this woman dares to trespass the rules. So immediately, we all know what a fatwa is, right? Fatwa, legal advice given by an authority of Islam, or whoever that is, right? Okay, the thousands of fatwas came in, of course, condemning Amina. And you know what Amina said? I don't care. I'm an American. I can do what I want. And this is the biggest headache for the Muslim society and the biggest headache for the Muslim Student Association. You see? So what we see first here in the United States, a community that is indigenous, that's United States community, they're African American. They started, do we know how they started? Through the Nation of Islam. Do we remember the Nation of Islam? And there was a man called Mr. Fard, and he had this inspiration, and he must have found some chapters of the Quran or some pages of the Quran, and he read that, and he felt that was the religion for African Americans, simply because it was empowering. But then, who knows about the Nation of Islam? Who knows? Who has ever read or met or anybody? So, well, anyway, he made that really a whole, how can I say it, system of black supremacy. And then he taught, right, that that non-black people were actually inferior. They were inferior to people of color. And so that was how, but what he actually taught was not Muslim at all. He just had these few pages of the Quran. He called himself Muslim. But of course, again, every Muslim who heard him speak was just absolutely dizzy and said, but this is not Islam. He calls himself Muslim. But then with Malcolm X, who made the pilgrimage to Mecca, it changed. Because he then started to study Islam and realized that what the nation was doing was really not according to the Islamic teachings. And so there was this split. And so now we have the Nation of Islam and we have the African-American Muslim community. And Malcolm X is a good example of how a lot of African-Americans have become Muslim in prison. In prison. There was a lot of prison ministry going on and actually Ingrid, I don't think she's here today, she told me that who works a lot with the death penalty and goes to prisons a lot, she said when African Americans, you know, start to follow Islam, you see a change. They become, their cells are cleaner, they become more somehow regular in what they do, you know, more disciplined. It's a change, it's an empowerment. It's a great tool of empowerment to get yourself through that life. And then when you come out, you, of course, stay Muslim. Now, so that is through the prisons. A lot of Muslims were converted. A lot of African-Americans were converted to Islam. And there is this endearing story because, like I told you yesterday, a lot of Muslims don't quite know the Arabic of the Quran. And so when they read the Quran, you know, they just take the words and take the blessing of the words without often knowing what exactly they mean. Well, one day, it was in one of the prisons here, a Lebanese Christian was incarcerated, and he knew Arabic. I thought, you can read the Quran for us. So he spent his prison time reading the Quran, and everybody assumed he was Muslim because he knew Arabic. But he wasn't, you know? And so this is how the level of knowledge was quite low. Now, Amina Wadud, however, do you have any idea when her generation, she's now, I think she's pushing 60, how her generation became Muslim? The civil rights movement. It became a tool against racism. And they often told me they became only Muslim in name, they had no clue what it was. Only later, like only 10, 20 years later, they would start to study the Quran and take lessons and so forth and so forth. So they became Muslim and then only filled it in, let's say, by the 1980s. Now, what does that mean when these Muslims started to define their Muslim, you know, identity and their studying? Again, it meant rumbling in the Muslim world. Because what did, for example, Amina Wadud do? She decided to study Islam, to go on for a PhD, and to read the Quran from the perspective of a woman. Whoa, that was so scary. Because what she did, she made a reinterpretation of the Quran. And the Quran, traditionally, could only be interpreted by man, right? 1400 years, interpretation by man only. So she was not the first one. It also happened in some other countries, but she was the one who received a lot of attention, and her book has been translated in many languages and is being read really carefully. And of course, lots of people don't agree with her, but it makes them think. And that's what you want. It makes them think like, hey, wait, you can read this holy book with different eyes. So you see, that African-American community has a huge influence, directly or indirectly. And these two groups, the group that, if you now have the group that became mainstream Islam, their headquarters are in Chicago, and they have a journal called The Muslim World. And also in Chicago, every September, you have a huge meeting of a group called ISNA, the Islamic Society of North America, ISNA. And ISNA came from the Muslim Student Association, but as we all know, and those of us who are older, as you get older, you get somewhat mellower, right? You tone down your extremist discourse, and that's what happened. So ISNA is now governed by former Muslim Student Association members who realize, wow, we better talk with these people around us, right? And we better just build bridges with non-Muslim communities. So ISNA has become quite influential in guiding the Muslims here in the United States and also in guiding them concerning their, what to do with their environment. Now, when ISNA meets in Chicago in September, the African-American Muslims meet as well, and they don't want to have anything to do with each other. And if you ever have to choose, go to the African-American meeting. It's so much more fun. They have music, they have batiks that they sell, they have great dinners, and great preaching. Great preaching, because as I said, Amina Wadud, her father was a Methodist preacher, and they have taken over that way of preaching.
In
What? And they preach in English. Thank you for adding that. They preach in English, not in Arabic. So it doesn't look like a spaceship. Like you remember what we said yesterday about Denmark? Okay, now let me see. Let me get facts, right? Okay. So the Nation of Islam is still based on black superiority and does not allow any intermarriage. No intermarriage between people of different colors. The African American group is led by Imam W.D. Muhammad. Maybe you heard about him. He's on the news regularly. And actually, what is very interesting, what makes these Muslims also so interesting, is that a lot of them have, you know, families that are half Baptist, half Muslim. So they come from very mixed background. And then we have and 40% of the Muslims in the United States is African American. Of the rest, of the 60% that is not, 20% are Shiite. And we know the love affair between Shiites and Sunnis, right? We still remember that, right? That there's often great animosity between the two groups. And Shiites will have their own mosques and their own organizations and will, if they mix. I actually happened to be with a Shiite woman from Pakistan at the ISNA meeting. And what I really noticed is that she absolutely didn't want to tell anybody what village she was from in Pakistan, who her mom and dad were, because the name would give it away. And of course, the S word never came out. She absolutely didn't want to mention that she was Shiite, because that was, you know, too hot. And she was also afraid, well, because what would have happened if she would have said in that Sunnite meeting, so ISNA is Sunnite. What would have happened if in ISNA, the Sunnite meeting, she would have said, oh, by the way, I'm a Shiite. What would happen? What?
She'd be ostracized.
She'd be ostracized or?
Killed.
No, not killed. Not quite. No, you're in America, remember? No, that's the system. You go to jail and you kill people for being a citizen. No, they would immediately put her in a corner or in a tiny room without windows and try to convert her. Because Sunnites believe that Shiites are all on the wrong track. You know, go to hell as well, remember? So hell is so full. Anyway. What?
The Kurds, because we think
the Kurds
are different than both of those.
Well, the Kurds can be Sunnite or Christian. So it depends, you know, and they often again have their own mosques.
The ones that we've known consider the Sunni as the Arabs. We don't have anything to do with the Arabs.
Right. Because you have Kurds, you have also some who are Shiite, but the majority is Sunnite and Christian, because Turkey. You know, a lot of Kurds in Turkey and Iraq and so forth and so forth. That's it. So there you bring it up, all these ethnicities. You see, we talked about that yesterday. There's so many ethnic groups, you can't count them anymore. So 20% of the Muslims are Shiite. Then I'm not sure about the percentage, nobody knows that. But what we also have is a considerable number of converts, USA converts, people who somehow are disenchanted with the church or disenchanted with whatever they were and find Islam. And of course, a lot of them are in mixed marriages, you see? So that would, we have quite a lot of converts who are becoming quite influential as well. So let us count it up for a minute. We have African American, we have converts, we have Shiite Sunnites, and all this becomes individualistic Americans. So you see, what we have is great potential for change. Change in the Muslim world, of ideas coming from the United States. And because we don't have only ISNA, we have also people going against ISNA and going against the Muslim Student Association and saying you're wrong. And the woman whose story I quoted a few lines from, she has hired a lawyer. And one of the lawyers was a Muslim called Khaled Abu Fadl, who, you know, not only represented her, but also knew the Muslim tradition so well that he could argue based on Islamic texts that what they were doing was wrong. Because as far as we know, there is no official Islamic text saying women have to come in through the back door. But that's again an invention of hyper-Muslim, you know, identity in the US, thinking, oh, we can make a back door, so let's make a back door for the women. And in the Netherlands, I saw another example of worse hyper-Muslim identity. There's a huge mosque in Amsterdam, huge. It can hold, if I'm not mistaken, 15,000 people. Guess what? No, not even a room, not even a back room for the women. Nothing for women at all. Well, is that hyper or not? You see? That's completely forgotten. There are women worshippers. Okay.
Excuse me, I have a question.
Yeah.
Is there a center of learning for these Muslims? Do they go someplace to learn this stuff so it'll be the same?
Right. Well, the problem is what we talked about yesterday, the breakup in religious authority. There used to be a center of learning. Have we all heard about the madrasa? Who has not heard about the madrasa? Okay, I'll better write it out before you think I'm saying mattress. The madrasa. The madrasa used to be the school. The madrasa started in the 12th century. And it's very... Remember, we hear the madrasa on the news. Can you read it, or is it too green?
Too
yeah. Light.
You need a new pen.
Light. Okay, again. I'll write it again. Oh, this is brown. Sorry.
Go away.
I keep finding a right color here. Okay. See? There we go. Is this better? The madrasa was set up in the 12th century. Actually, it was set up to battle Shi'ism, the Shiites, because the Shiites had become so popular that the Sunnite authority says we have to do something. Now, what was the case with education in the entire Muslim world? The curriculum of the madrasa was set. And wherever you went to a madrasa, you learned the same curriculum. So you could go to Egypt, you could go to a place in Russia, you could go to Malaysia, Indonesia, you would learn exactly the same texts and material. And so through the madrasa, there was a great uniformity. And then built over the madrasa were universities. For example, there was a huge university that still exists in Egypt, Al-Azhar. And so people who wanted to go on after the madrasa could go there. And people from the whole world would gather there and study, and they all would know Arabic. The language in the madrasa was Arabic, and they all would learn again the same material. So lots of unification, right? Now that was broken up by the 19th century when Muslims woke up to the fact that in the madrasa you don't study engineering. You don't study medicine. You don't study anything that you need in modern life. And so they realize we need other schools. And the only way to get that system going was to break up the madrasas. And so in a lot of countries, the ruler said, close the madrasa, that's it. Go learn the Quran somewhere else. Now, that is actually the beginning of the vacuum in religious authority that we are coping with today. Because now you can go anywhere to study. You can go to someone in Saudi Arabia, and they will welcome you and pay you. You know, any of you, if you want to say, I want to study in Saudi Arabia, they will pay you. If you say, I want to become a Muslim, that's it. You can also go to a more progressive place. You see, so, and there, or you can go to a more traditional place, or you can go to a more extremist place. So that's what when we now see madrasa, we only hear it in the context of an extremist place, don't we?
Right.
But the Taliban, they were all coming from the madrasa.
Pakistan.
Huh?
In Pakistan,
hotbed of extremism. So you can choose. And so you choose your leader, and that leader decides what you learn. You see? So then you come out, it doesn't mean that everybody agrees with you. In the old days, everybody would agree with you. So, where do they go? The places I mentioned. Saudi Arabia, Egypt, or they stay here. They just go to regular universities and do regular study of Muslim studies here. You see? So that is a huge problem. So you brought up this problem, which is very good. I'm very happy about that because it's one of the things I was going to talk about. Who can lead the Coptic community? Remember, we talked about that yesterday. Who has the authority to lead the community? Well, the Muslim Studies Association explains the Quran in the most simple fashion possible. Because if you want to unify, you have to simplify, remember? Isn't that the origin? Isn't that the guideline of politics? Right, simplify. Now, what does it mean? It means that they will say, okay, you ask, remember, you can ask a fatwa. You can ask, can I have a heart transplant? In the traditional Islamic, universe, you can have two answers, yes or no. You can have yes from a scholar who reads certain texts. You can have no from a scholar who reads other texts. And it is up to you to choose. And what will you choose?
Your own life.
What?
Your life.
What you need. If you need a new heart, you say yes. If you don't need a new heart, you can say no. Right? So it's up to you to choose. Now, you go to these more extremist-minded Muslims, they will want to force one answer. Say, it is no, and that's it. Right? Now, the problem now is that other people go and study in other places and start to dispute them. They say, you are wrong. And there is, for example, this lawyer who is helping this woman. His name is Khalid Abul Fadl, who is a lawyer and he's a scholar of Islam. He has written several books. Has any of you ever heard of him? He has written several books simply shooting holes in the whole reasoning of the more extremist-minded Muslims and saying, I am sorry, what you are teaching us is baloney. You are not looking at the whole tradition. Now, guess what this means to him?
He's a death threat.
What?
He's got a death threat.
He has bodyguards. He has several bodyguards always with him. He can no longer go around by himself. He has death threats.
Will you write the word, this fatwa word?
Fatwa? Sure, the fatwa word? Sure.
Is that a decision? Is a fatwa a decision?
No, a fatwa is an advice. It's a legal advice. Now, thank you for asking me, but let me first tell you one second where the first Muslims were, and then we go on up to the fatwas. Because the fatwas are so fun. Who has ever looked on the web and looked up fatwas? No, you should. Yeah, just look up fatwa and you get tons of websites with all kinds of advices and very, very detailed. You say, don't these people have anything else to do? You know, like, can I wear light blue buttons on my dark blue dress? You know, come on, there's more to life. But, you know.
In English,
there's lots in English, French, Dutch, Arabic. You can choose any language you want. You have fatwas everywhere. Now, so the first recorded or documented Muslim group, do we have any idea where that was?
In the U.S. or
in the U.S., the first recorded, sorry, we're talking about the U.S., the first recorded Muslim group, Muslim community in the U.S., a clue where that was?
North Dakota.
How did you know?
Told us in a different class.
It was in North Dakota, right, in Ross, and nobody knows where that is. Does anybody know here? I have no clue where Ross, North Dakota is. Right. And then, and then the second community was in Iowa, Cedar Rapids. The second, you know, considerable large community. So it was not New York. And then we have in Detroit, we have large communities, LA, Chicago has a huge community, and so forth. Now, the countries of origin, I told you that, they come from all over. So now to unify these people, we need to educate them, right? To say, we all want them to know, to learn the same about the Quran. So building schools is a huge priority for Muslims here. Building Muslim schools all over the states where they teach, of course, Islam and the U.S. curriculum. That's now. And then the second priority is, how do I live as a Muslim in this country? And maybe you remember that from the other class. What, again, was the most burning issue connected with the schools and how to live here?
The prom,
right. The prom. And that shows the prom is so weird. Would you ever think about the prom? Because it shows everything that the battle is about. It shows, can a girl go alone to a party? Can she dance at that party? It's not just being there, can she dance at that party? Can she listen to the music at that party? Right? And then, here we move into a very dangerous area. Can she mix with
boys?
Can she mix with boys? Right? And so, and last time when we talked about this, someone came to me and said that at her school there was a girl who was not allowed to go to the prom, and then the mother put up a fight with the dad because it was the dad who was forbidding her, and then in the end it was decided she could go with her uncle. And that was that made her pass. So I'm not going, thank you very much. So the other thing is, yes, you can go, but with your father, mother, uncle, brother, whoever. You see? The thing is this, in the prom, if you end up in the prom, it means you have become so Americanized that you party in that way, listen to the music, dance, and mix with non-Muslims. You see? So the other big fatwas are about Muslim proms. How do you do that? That's undecided so far as I can see. It's more like girls having a party with girls and boys having a party with boys. But then the big battle is, can you have music? Because very extremist Muslims forbid music. You see? They also forbid dancing. So what's left? What's left? Dancing. They forbid music, they forbid dancing. So what's left of the prom? Huh? What?
Just the punch.
The punch. That's it. You stand around the punch. Thank you.
At a prom, nobody
can drink. Because you're under 21.
Right.
I assume that there's no prom that has anything else but punch. Right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And they address the question of prom dresses.
Whoa. Prom dresses.
Bare shoulders.
Again, a very dangerous area.
Yes.
Bare shoulders. Showing a lot. Attractive. You know, what do you think the answer is there? No way. So, Muslim prom dresses. You know, you have to think about that. But you see, all these issues concern the identity. the hyper-identity. What can you do? And don't forget, as I said yesterday about Muslims in Europe, a lot of Muslims can't care less. They say, I don't care. But they stay away. In the end, they often stay away from the mosque, you see, especially when the mosque is taken over by more extremist-minded groups. And they just live their own life. And they take decisions for themselves. And they somehow have gotten over the idea that they go to hell. So that is what a lot of Muslims, you know, that's the way a lot of Muslims solve the problems. And a lot of Muslims also don't want their children to go to Muslim schools because they feel then they are not prepared well enough for the competitive universities. So there's a lot going on in that field. Now, but the problem was all about morals. Remember that? Morality. We have to write that. So two M words, morality or morals. It is all about morals. When we come back to the quote, like a woman who is pregnant out of wedlock, she will be stoned according to Islamic law, or in Pakistan she will be locked up. And in this case in America, they will, you know, have a trial because she came in through the man's door and she has a son out of wedlock. You see, it is morality. Morality is really the battleground that we're speaking about. Because the moment you move into the Western morality, all is lost. You are no longer concerned a Muslim. Now, what is this Western morality?
There is none.
Huh?
There is none.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. I think we will all have very different ideas in this one room. And can you find a more unified community than people in Holden? You know? There is none. Again, remember what I keep saying, it's all in the mind. So again, it is the worst of the worst that is being imagined. You know, oh, my daughter is going to marry, God forbid, a Jew from New York who has become secular. And, you know, and then they want, God knows what they do with the child, they won't teach him Islam. And so three people are lost for Islam. You see? And so... So that is why, that is the first defense. And I told you, were you there when I told you the story about Sayyid Qutb? Maybe you don't remember. Because where does this come from? Where does this idea, this fear come from? Well, first of all, I don't want to exaggerate, but first of all, it comes from TV. You know, what do we see on TV? Mr. Qutb. Sayyid Qutb, S. Qutb. I'll tell you in a minute. But we know, what do we see on TV? What do we see on TV? When we look at
a wild picture of the U.S.
A wild picture.
Dallas and all life.
Dallas,
desperate
dynasty.
Housewives.
Desperate housewives.
Baywatch.
What?
Baywatch.
Yeah. I mean, all these bare bodies. All these people, you know, after knowing each other half an hour, jumping in bed with each other.
Yeah.
That's what you see on TV, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, I remember the first time I came here, I had such a terrible complex because I thought everybody had big hair. That's what I saw on TV. I thought, whoa, these people are so blessed, you know. We have all this and they are standing up. Anyway. When I came here, I realized this was not normal. But again, like me, there are millions of Muslims. By the way, I have to tell you this. The streets of Cairo were empty in the 80s when Dallas or Dynasty was on. empty. And then if later in the evening you would take a taxi with heavy discussions. And I forgot the main actors in there. But and also the one who really incited the imagination most, you will never guess who that was.
Miss Ellie.
Who?
Miss Ellie.
Miss Ellie. Ronald Reagan's first wife.
Oh,
no?
Jane
first.
Jane.
She played in something.
The Falcon Crest.
Yeah.
And I would say, no wonder he divorced her. Is she? You see? But you see, it is taken as reality. It is taken as reality. So that is the mindset. Now, that reality came home to Mr. Said Qutb in the 50s when he was here in the States. He was a member of the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt. He was also working for the educational department in Egypt. And Egypt sent him to the States to learn about education. And some nice, do you remember the story now?
Yeah.
Some nice Christians, because this is where the origin lies, where the origin of this fear lies. Some nice Christians invited him to a social in the church, and it was in the church basement. It's written down, it's published, you can read it if you want. And there in the basement, what happened? Do you remember?
Dancing, square dance?
Dancing? Of who was dancing?
Men and women.
Men and women, were they married?
No.
No. And what did the pastor do of all things?
Dance.
He turned down the lights. So, Said Qutb went home and knew. This is the end of American society. It will fall apart really soon. And he wrote a book about that. But that was somehow what made him think about culture and its influence on the Muslim world. And so his first idea was, we should keep this out. Now, why this is important? Because in the 1950s, not that many Muslims moved here. Now, many Muslims have moved here, but the descendants of Mr. Qutb, they now are becoming, you know, Muslim Student Association leaders, and they want to keep that culture out. But you happen to be in the States, you see? So how do you do that? You divide the world in two realms, and that's what Said Qutb did. He divided the world in good Muslims and the rest. And the rest is packed with people who call themselves Muslim, but according to Ms. Qutb, are not. You see? And so that is the mindset of extremists who want to find ways of Muslims to live here. And so, of course, what are the big discussions about? The big discussions are about food, work, banking, investing, medicine. What can you all accept? Where can you, when you drop down and you are a woman, can a male doctor treat you, right? And so forth and so forth. So there's all these discussions going on of how can I be a Muslim in this country? Can I invest in something that potentially invests in pork? The answer is no. So you have all these lists of companies that do things that according to Islam are not permitted. Can I work in something? Can I have any gainful employment in an area that, according to Islam, is forbidden? What is the answer?
No.
No. And so but there are so many shadow areas that the Prophet Muhammad never spoke about. So there is this constant discussion of going on, and that's why you have these hundreds of fatwas. Can I do this? Can I do that? I heard that I was offered a nice job with Citibank, but I hear that Citibank invests in areas that are not allowed by Islam. Should I take the job or not? And so you see, one scholar will say yes, take it because you gotta eat. Another say no, don't take it. You see, so again, there's this huge disjunction between real life and living your life in America, the ideal and the ideal of Islam and what you imagine to be pure. And so in the meantime, you have underlying that all these new upcoming scholars and these people like Amina Wadud saying, well, I think I'm going to do this. Because everybody, as I said, becomes individualistic. I'm going to do this. I'm going to do that. I'm going to explain it this way. And I like it. And so you see, you have a huge, literally, it's a melting pot, but it's very vibrant what is happening in the States. And it's again these two powers against each other, the so-called pure Muslims and Muslims who want to adapt to the United States and use, you know, the methods and the what we call enlightenment thinking and apply that to Islam and write books about that. So what we are seeing is not just a battle, but we are also seeing many new models coming from the United States. And these books are translated back into the Muslim world. And of course, they're forbidden, a lot of them, and they're hidden. And of course, if you forbid a book and hide it, what happens? Everybody reads it. Right. So you see, what we are looking at is something very interesting. We think about all these people who, I saw your hand, by the way. I saw you. We think about, you know, the hijackers and all these people who want to throw bombs and attack the Sears Tower and so forth and so forth. But really what is happening in the United States is extremely interesting. And the more someone, because the more this happens, the more missionaries, the more Muslim missionaries will be shipped to the States. Has any of you ever met one? Because, for example, in Valparaiso University, where I teach, we had an interfaith meeting to commemorate. We had an interfaith meeting to commemorate the year that passed after 9/11. And as we came out of that meeting, there was an imam from Michigan City. And right there on the spot, he tried to convert me. You know, there you come out of an interfaith meeting, and he just tried to, you know, pound so many words in my head that I would just get mush and say, okay, I'll become a Muslim. But that's how it goes, you know, like see, this is the truth, this is logic. What this Christianity is not logic, Jesus is not logic, that he's divine is not logic, Trinity is totally not logic. What we have is logic. Why don't you see the logic? And it would go on and on and on. And they can be very strong, you know? And so that is, but of course, their first targets are these prom-going Americans. You see? That's their first target, and parents will allow it. Okay, what did you want to ask?
I'm just curious, the Muslim Student Association chapters on campuses in the United States.
Everywhere.
Do they tend to be, if they're more radical or extremist, are they from other countries primarily, or are they American members as well? And do the extremists tend to be Shia or Sunni? Or
The Muslim Student Association is Sunni. It's Sunni because it comes from Egypt and it was inspired by Said Qutb. They're Sunnite. But the main leaders come from the Middle East, but then through their missionary activities, they have gained a lot of, you know, followers in Pakistan, India, and in the States. And yes, there are quite a few converts in the States who have become not so much extremist, but quite radical in their thinking. Yeah.
Millie?
As in, I don't want to mix with Christians, I don't want interfaith dialogue, because one of the things, I hear you, one of the things is that interfaith dialogue is really considered a tool of Christian denomination, or domination and conversion. So dialogue is often frowned upon and seen as something very suspected. You see, by these groups, they feel, okay, they get us in and we eat with them, and then the next thing is they invite us to church, and. You see, well, why do they think that? What?
They do the same thing.
Exactly, because it's what they do themselves, so it's just, yeah. Yeah?
Just one question. In post 9/11, how are these people getting visas to get into this country?
Well, people get visas in many ways. They get visas simply because they want to study.
Okay.
And also, right now, we had a long time the number of students from Muslim countries was drastically diminished after 9/11. Because they didn't want to come and because they did not get visas. Now it has just started again. Has any of you noticed that? Any of you teachers somewhere where you noticed that? In Valparaiso, for example, we used to have a large group from the Gulf countries in Saudi Arabia. Then it was just a handful, and now it's over 100 again. That just came this year. Yeah. So they now are starting to get visas again. Yeah. And I don't know. The thing is this. We know now from Europe and from America, there might be people right here plotting and planning.
Mm-hmm.
We don't know where they are. Mm-hmm. If you have, if you believe, if you follow, I saw a hand there, I saw, if you believe in Said Qutb, who divides the world, because this is what he did, by dividing the world in two, us and the rest, it means that the rest, when the rest is branded as non-Islamic, it means you can fight the rest. And that is new. That is why, you know, for many centuries Muslims didn't do that. And that is why we now have all these attacks. It started with him in the 50s when he philosophized what should a pure Muslim community do, how do you recognize it? And the first decision was stay away from the rest. The second was protect yourself against the rest. The third, protect yourself against the rest by fighting them. And that is what people who want to attack us and 9/11 and so forth, that's what they were doing, the third option. Protect yourself against the rest by fighting them. When I talk with extremists in Cairo, I say, what do you really want? They said, well, we want our own Muslim world and leave us alone. I say, fine. I can leave you alone. You know? You pull all the Muslims here in the States out and bring them back. Do you think anybody wants to go back? Do the same in Europe? But that's the idea. They want everybody, that they basically, you have Russia, you have China, you have the US, you have Europe, you have a Muslim caliphate. Do you remember? The Muslim, the caliph. A Muslim area that the Muslim law can be applied, where all Muslims can live in peace and harmony. As they're doing right now,
yes.
Right? And so that is the idea, you see? That is the ultimate vision of this mindset. But of course we know, would it ever work in this world that has become so globalized? Because what they find the greatest enemy, what was it again? Who remembers?
Secularism.
Secularism is the greatest enemy. They think, they assume that we have become all so secular that God has left us. Yeah, and it means they don't know us. They don't know what we are really thinking, believing. You see? So for them, secularism is the beginning of the end of Islamic religion, and as I've said a few times this week, so the greatest sin for any Muslim is to let Islam die out. That's the greatest sin that a Muslim can commit. So you cannot do that. Yeah, I saw two hands. I saw three hands. Now, you were first, and then you, and then you in the back. Yeah?
You may have, in your comments just a minute ago, I guess you kind of touched on this a little bit, but you were saying that, new Islam models coming out of the U.S. and then how those come back to the Arab world or whatever, and they're against them, and then they would send like missionaries over to combat those ideas. Do you see that in the U.S. as an increase in those missionaries coming, and as a result, an increase in extremism, or it's too hard to tell?
I think it's a result of the initiatives that started in the 70s and that are now maturing. More and more young people, mostly men, are graduating and need a job.
But what I'm saying is that because of these, them sending out the missionaries, and more, from the Middle East, sending more of them to the U.S.
Right.
To try to correct Muslim beliefs, does that imply that extremism would be on the rise in the U.S.?
Well, yes and no. Extremism seems to be on the rise because it has become more vocal. That's one thing. Secondly, remember we talked about how extremists take over mosques. They will go into a mosque that was, built by people from all over. They had a concerted effort to start a mosque. They will go in and take over. And suddenly the mosque seems extremist. But what it means is that people leave, say nothing, or go home and never go back to a mosque. So you see, it's on the rise, but it in a very strange way. It's not a natural development. Now, do they manage to reconvert lots of Muslims? Yes and no. They manage to get following among young people who see them joining those groups as a way of upward mobility. Because it can give you power. You can become the ruler, the leader in a mosque. You can become the leader of the student association. And so they are the ones who have the platform. Their voice is heard. You come, I look in Valparaiso, the voice that is heard is the voice of the Muslims who don't want to dance, who don't want music. I ask Muslims privately, do you ever listen to music? Of course, I have my MP3 player loaded. You see? So there is this, but they don't dare to say anything. They don't dare to say, they don't dare to stand up and say, well, I'm sorry, I don't agree with you. I once had a woman in my class whose parents were Sufi mystics, and she told about how she believed as a Muslim. They tried to absolutely butcher her. You know? They tried, they stood up and said that what she was doing was not the right Islam and this and that. Thank God she stood her ground. She said, well, I'm sorry, this is how I was raised, and I get a lot of consolation of being Muslim like this, and I don't care what you say. But they just on the spot, in the class, they tried to show her that she was totally wrong. So there is, but again, you know, there's always this fear. I always say a secular Muslim will always still respect the Quran and will still respect the religion. So will not stand up and say to someone who speaks in the name of Islam, what you are saying doesn't make sense. Mm-hmm. Plus, as I said, by Khalid Abu Fadl, you end up with bodyguards. So that's another aspect of what's happening. You know, but so they thrive on fear, on violence, and so what basically has to happen is that the people who are moderate have to stand up and make their own associations and say, I don't think this any longer. It's the same everywhere. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Some sort of a philosophy based on fear. So I think about what's going on in our country now. Mm-hmm. We talk about you have to present, they have to believe that God has left us.
Mm-hmm.
And I think about Red Week right here in our news about how they were the evil ones.
Right.
That God has left them.
Right.
I hear you talk about it's okay to come into a country spread a philosophy based on what you feel is the best thing. I hear us say everyone must experience a democracy.
Right.
So somehow the answer cannot lie in us playing the game by their rules. I mean, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, somehow someone's got to stop the cycle of who is the evildoer.
Right.
And
well, you know, extremism. There are books that have researched extremism in Hinduism, Buddhism even,
yes.
Islam, Christianity, and extremists have a lot in common.
Mm-hmm.
They have way more in common, you know, they don't have to be from the same religion.
No.
They all want to do the work for God. They want to, like, represent the mind of God as they see it,
yes.
and force others to accept that.
Yes.
That's what an extremist does. Now, the thing in the States is, of course, freedom. Again, this woman, as she said, in the freedom in the States, nobody can touch her.
Right.
You see, the difference between the Muslim world and the countries, you know, the countries where people come from and here, is that we have the freedom. We have a law system. So people can react, and they can stand up and say, I'm not taking it. But the method of instilling fear is very universal. Yeah, and I cannot, you know, you cannot go into all that. We talk about Islam in America today, which by itself is such an enormous topic. We could go on all summer.
Mm-hmm.
But you see, just to condense it, to show some of the main issues that are going on. But in the end, what you do see in the States is that individualism and the freedom to think for yourself takes over. And again, extremists don't like that.
So if you question, let's say, a common practice like wiretapping or something because it would violate our freedom, then that would be something we really need to continue to question, continue to talk about our Bill of Rights.
Yeah, of course.
To talk about
of course. Of course, we always have to continue. And yeah, some people are hungry. You can stay if you have any questions. But if you want to go to say, I need my food, go ahead. You were first.